Before I introduce this evening's speaker, I'd like to remind you of a few unusual timings in our program this term, however. The speaker next week is in normal sequence, Mr. Dirk Reineveld, who's the senior prosecuting trial attorney in the trial of Slobodan Milosevic in The Hague in the Netherlands. The February 5th talk, however, has been moved to February the 3rd, which is a Thursday night in this room at 7:30 rather than at 8:15 when Professor Stephen Tope will be speaking as part of a conference at UBC. To make things even more confusing, the next lecture on Saturday, February the 12th, which is also sponsored by St. John's College, like this evening's lecture, will be held in the recital hall of the UBC Music Building when Mr. D.D. Jackson will be speaking on jazz being classical. No lecture on February the 19th, midterm break, but on February 22nd, we have the youngest brother of the Dalai Lama coming to speak, Tenzin Choyal, who is talking about personal transformation. Many of you here, I think, were with me when we were privileged to hear the Dalai Lama here in 1980 when he actually talked to the Institute. We tried to get him last year, but he was just too much in demand, so a few people were lucky enough to hear him in the Chan Center. 10,000 people turned out to UBC, and we were able to squeeze about a tenth of that number into this building. So this will be also sponsored by St. John's College. Otherwise, the lectures proceed in normal sequence with no lecture on Easter Saturday or on April the 9th. It's a great pleasure to start the season with one of Western Canada's best-known writers, Sharon Boutala, who is known for a series of books, fiction, nonfiction, and short stories going back to the early to mid-1980s, books that have received nominations for Governor General's Award and Commonwealth Writers Award, have received awards in numerous competitions. Many of you are aware of her great trilogy about the prairies, Perfection of the Morning, Coyote's Morning Cry, and Wild Stone Heart. She was awarded the Marion Engel Award in 1998 and the Order of Canada in 2001. Her works cover the gamut of human emotions in both Western Canada and on a broader plane. Her recent novel, 1998, Garden of Eden, ranged from Saskatchewan to Ethiopia. The Globe and Mail said of her work, "Fiction so well crafted that it simply won't let us go. Books in Canada, she writes with scrupulous honesty and without a lick of pretension. Canadian Forum, an extraordinary glimpse into the female psyche. Or Toronto Star, one of this country's true visionaries." She has also written for the Globe and Mail, Maclean's, Western Living, and even Flair. Her connection with Vancouver, I discovered, this is where the web is a wonderful thing, goes back at least to 1988, when one of five of her unpublished plays, A Killing Frost, was performed at the Vancouver Fringe. She was trained as a teacher, but has been a writer for a very long time. She lives in the southwestern part of Saskatchewan in a nature reserve that she and her husband Peter created near the town of East End. She's also involved in conservation activity, not just of wildlife, but of architecture. I think she was one of the people instrumental in having the Wallace Stegner House, the great American environmental writer, turned into a heritage site in East End where Canadian writers could go and live for almost nothing. Well, I think this gives you an idea of what we have awaiting us this evening. It's a great pleasure for me, who was raised in Western Canada, Churchill, Manitoba, University of Manitoba, and then have been here in the far west of Canada for the last 35 years, to hear Ms. Boutala on what makes a Westerner. Sharon Boutala.
Thank you so much for that very generous introduction. I probably don't need that because I have this. Can everyone hear me? Oh, okay, great. Well, I probably shouldn't tell you, but I'm just a little bit terrified here. You can be just moderately terrified, you know. It's not that I'm not used to making speeches all the time, but this is a very prestigious venue, and I'm not used to making speeches at prestigious venues. So, anyway, it's a great honor to have been asked. I'm really very delighted to be here, and thank you all for coming. I frankly wouldn't have been surprised if no one had. I chose the topic, What Makes a Westerner, because a book I just finished writing, which will be out in March, the end of March, is called Lilac Moon, Dreaming of the Real West. The book is out with HarperCollins Canada, and that's its subject, actually. So it would seem that that should be something I, by now, ought to know a little bit about. Also, of course, as with many of you here, I imagine, I was born and have spent all but four of my 64, almost 65 years in Western Canada, and my family have been on all sides pioneers. So when HarperCollins agreed that I ought to write this book, they said to me that, part of the contract was that I would include in it information about my family. You know, that the story, the argument, I think, should be threaded through with family stories, because they stand in for all our family stories. So I have to begin by saying, regrettably, and maybe some of you will go home when you hear this, that I'm really only writing about the Prairie Provinces. My original plan had been to include British Columbia, but HarperCollins made the decision that I should leave it out on the grounds that I would probably be writing the book until I was 95 if I tried to include all the amazing and interesting things about this very huge and interesting and, you know, very various province. So, even though, as with almost every, well, I should probably just say how many of you here were born in Saskatchewan or raised in Saskatchewan, or your mom and dad were. Yeah, right. Well, thank you very much for sticking with a prairie person here. So, you know, my point is made. I have at least one. Oh, no, I have two sisters here tonight who live in BC, one of whom has been here over 40 years. So it's impossible to separate the prairie from BC, except in the way that you do when you write a book and say, I'm not going to talk about BC. So I think I'll begin. I'm going to keep referring to the text. I realize Peter Nemetz said that this is an audience which prefers its speakers not to read from a text, but to just talk about the subject. Well, I would rather have a text, I'll tell you. So I brought my book. If words fail me, I'll just read. Okay. Anyway, this is from the preface. It's called A Western Family. Friday, December 13th, 2002. I am 62 years and 3 months old and have spent all but five of those years in Saskatchewan and only four of them outside Western Canada. When my husband and I made the decision to bring our five-year-old son back home to begin school where we had gone to school, and despite the eagerness with which we'd left, at last the wider world, it was made with relief and an absence of regret of any kind. A poet said something about having to leave and come home again to know the place for the first time, so it was for me. We'd been driving for 5 days when we finally pulled up in front of a small shopping center on the edge of Saskatoon. My husband went inside to buy some small item, and I sat in the car, my little boy on my knee, and watched the people walking by. I saw faces that I hadn't seen for 5 years. I saw that they were Saskatchewan faces, and I was amazed, not knowing until that moment of return to my homeland, that there was such a thing as a Saskatchewan face. One more little story here that was the beginning of this book in mentally. I'd begun my adulthood as a painter, and so for the 4 years we lived in Halifax, I was a frequent visitor to the traveling shows at the Nova Scotia College of Art and Design. Sometime near the end of our 4 years there, we went to see an exhibition of the works of the Regina Five. Art Mackay, Kenneth Lockheed, Douglas Morton, Ted Godwin, and Ron Boer. At that time, the gallery was actually simply a large hall where shows were temporarily hung. Expecting nothing special, we walked in, my husband setting down our child, me beginning to slide off my coat, and before I'd had time to do more than merely make a sweeping survey around the hall full of pictures, abstract works not traditionally representative, I was hit so hard I could feel the wind that I literally nearly fell down. There it was, my prairie home, pale, bathed in light, vast, windswept, and open, everything that Nova Scotia, with its dense forests, its worn-down mountains, its hilly, winding roads, was not. So these things were the kinds of things that started me off on my investigation of the question, what makes a Westerner, my realization for the first time in my life that I am a Westerner, and what does that mean? What the West is, what it means to be a Westerner, what the Western experience is, and thus the Western soul, or what this book is about. From the Selkirk settlers, who arrived in the early 19th century, to the greatest in-migration of the late 19th and early 20th centuries, we non-Aboriginal people can boast only 100 to fewer than 200 years on this western part of the continent, not long compared to European families or to the people who were already here when the first of us came from Europe. Again and again, our poets have challenged us. Who are we? They ask, not Europeans, most of us today never having set foot on that continent, present company excepted, of course. Yet in the face of Aboriginal people who have been here at the most since the world began, or at least since the end of the last ice age, at least 14,000 years ago, we claim only uncertainly to be natives to this new continent. Thus, we have no unchallengeable answer to that question, and our failure to find one or our lack of certainty in what we do assert about who we are is our basic, if unspoken, anxiety, and it is the one that I think haunts all Western Canadians. So, that's kind of where I began. It's not kind of, it is where I began. Now, I have all these pages here, so I hope you will be patient with me. I'm not daring to just wing it yet. I'll get a little bolder if you are nice. So I thought that I would, well, actually what I did here on this page was just before I came here, I thought, because I didn't feel I had all the ideas in this complex and long book. This is a single-spaced manuscript. That I could even see clearly having, I wrote the book, you know, it wasn't anybody else who wrote it, but I wasn't sure that I could just separate the pieces and speak in any comprehensive and sensible way about it. So I forced myself to sit down and check off the way that I organized the book. So the first section is on our attitudes toward what we call the wilderness, and ourselves as a rural people or an urban people and so on. The second section has to do with our very troubled and uncertain and very long relationship with the Aboriginal people of our continent. And the third chapter, because I am, well, I should have perhaps preface this by saying that that this is an idiosyncratic book in the sense that if an historian had written it, he or she would have chosen different subject and would have handled this very differently. This is a literary essay. It is not a work of history. And because I wrote it, and because of my background as a writer about Western people and Western lives, I decided simply to choose the things that interest me. Okay, I'm a woman, so there's a chapter on Western women. I'm half French-Canadian. We were Leblancs, who were originally Acadians. So there's a chapter on French in the West. And I have particular interest, of course, in our relationship with the Aboriginal people, so I did a whole chapter on that, and so on and so forth. As an artist, there's actually a chapter on Western art, but I won't probably get anywhere near that tonight. So the way I decided to tackle this subject was I began with an attempt to, you know, I talk about dreaming of the real West. So I took each of these groups of people at various times in our history and said, what were their dreams? And when you think of what the dreams of these various groups of people are, you realize that they were contradictory. And some have been fulfilled, but most haven't. The other thing that I was interested in was what we think about ourselves and what other people think about us, and therefore what the myths on which we base our society are, and whether if I deconstructed them, I could find out that they were in fact based on a truth or on dreams or not. So roughly, this is just a kind of categorization of the ideas we have of ourselves. And you know, this is going to, well, I would be disappointed if it didn't create a great deal of discussion and controversy, and I expect to be yelled at quite a lot. But I'm getting a bit used to that. So, in other words, you may not agree. You may have more and better ideas. So first of all, I think that Westerners would say, if they were asked when they were elsewhere, that Western Canada is a more egalitarian society than the older societies in Central Canada and in the Atlantic provinces. I always have to accept the North, because the North is sort of the prairie provinces squared in a lot of ways. And of course, I always accept Aboriginal people because their culture is, that's something else. So I'm really only talking about Euro-Canadians unless I otherwise specify. So I think we believe that we have a more fluid and open society, by which I mean that you might be born in the proverbial log cabin like I was on the edge of the boreal forest in Saskatchewan in 1940 and arrive at this point here tonight, or that I might be invited to dinner at Peter Lougheed's house, which has never happened, by the way. So, you know, you see what my point is, that I knew very well in Nova Scotia I was not going to be invited to dinner at the houses of any of the first families that ran the provinces there. Would I be in Saskatchewan? Would I be in BC? I'm going to leave that an open question. I personally don't think so. But on the other hand, sometimes I think about people I've seen, you know, and I know what's gone on in their lives, and I think, well, maybe not. Also, I think we believe that we're freer to lead the life that we choose here, that our society is open enough to the extent that if you choose to lead a certain life, even if you're born into a certain class that would say you can't lead that life, that in fact you could do so here where you wouldn't be able to in other parts of the country. Another big category is our closeness to nature. We have tended to believe that we are closer to nature in the Western provinces than the other older provinces. You see what I mean? In the North, this is a ridiculous statement. Everyone who lives up there is involved in nature. But compared to the other half of Canada, I think, as you will see if you read the book, because I'll probably never get to it tonight, we certainly do not only live closer to nature, even though we're urban, nature is closer to us, that in all of the big Western cities, you're just moments away from a place like the endowment lands, the beaches, the mountains, biking trails, and cougars stalk the streets of Swift Current, Saskatchewan, as well as right here. Thompson, Manitoba has the same kind of bear problem that West Vancouver and, I hear, also North Vancouver have. And, you know, every little town and city, well, actually, this applies to parts of Ontario, too, the ones that are closest to the Manitoba border, but we do have a very close relationship with nature out here, whether we want to or not. I don't know where this fits in this whole idea, but I think Westerners, more than any other people, except perhaps, once again, Northerners, have a very mythic view of ourselves and of ourselves, our culture, and our societies. And especially this is true of people in the Prairie Provinces, because of the myth of the pioneer and so on and so forth. I think that to carry from that point, we also have the idea that our immediate past was an heroic one. And I think that that's something that we all believe. I know in the Prairie Provinces, it is worth your life to question the heroism of the pioneers. So out of that also comes the supposition that, or the belief we have about ourselves as a rather tough people, strong people, people who are more forthright and direct in our discourse, that it is our style, and it reflects a straighter, less devious character than them awful Easterners. It's not that I can't speak English, but this is where I live. This is how people say things, those pesky Easterners. And I think that we really do believe this of ourselves, and we actually see it in people like Ralph Klein, for instance, who, Lord knows, is often a little too straightforward, to the point where he embarrasses even Westerners, or at least he embarrasses people from Saskatchewan. I wouldn't say that people from Alberta are rather admiring of him, even if they don't like his politics, because his style, they think, is typical of the true Westerner. Okay, now, this is not any way that I had planned to do this. It's all right here, and I'm not doing any of it. So I don't know if this is good or not. I'm getting braver, maybe. That's all that's happening. Okay, the other thing that, as a woman, I don't know if people who have spent their lives in the university community see this or agree with it or not, but it seems to me that most of Canada believes, and Westerners certainly believe, that the West is a place where real men reside. And I do have a chapter on what that's all about. And think about the Calgary Stampede. When you see all these businessmen, bankers, the proverbial banker, you know, and university professors also, and Ralph Klein, Donna Stetson, and, the belt with the big silver buckle and the cowboy boots, and pretend they're cowboys for a week. And I do know, because I do live in the middle of cowboy culture and have for about almost 30 years now, that those men have tremendous, tremendous pride in who they are. And that this idea, in fact, that's why they tend to be so self-effacing and quiet and kind of the aw shucks ma'am persona. They are so sure of themselves as real men that they don't need to brag or boast. And I can tell you from personal experience that it is anybody who brags is regarded, that's the worst thing you can possibly do in that culture, because you already are the real thing. You don't have to undermine it, you know. In fact, this is an aside, definitely not in my speech, and probably doesn't apply in Vancouver, but one of the first things that I noticed when I moved into that culture was that urban people would ask the rural people, not understanding that this was really a rude question, the equivalent of saying, how much money do you make? What's your salary? They would say, how much land do you have? How many cows have you got? And that ranchers would then give this, what I think people who speak a kind of language I never speak would say, they give him that shit-eating grin and say, oh, I just got a few cows, you know, or, oh, not very much, I only got a section, when everyone around knew we had 12 sections and 5,000 head, you know. Where this is very odd when you think about it. Most of us would do the opposite. We would try to make ourselves sound a little better. But that's because we're not so sure, eh? When you're a countryman with cattle and land, you're a king. So, I've been married to a king for a long time. I know this very well. The husband in Nova Scotia was a different husband. He was not a king. So, I guess, I think I'm down to the bottom of my list, except to say that, and it was these real men who built the West. And, you know, these are not Aboriginal men. These are European men. Although they would, of course, never see themselves as European. So, that is, that in these and other less easily specified ways, the quality of our experience is different than that of other Canadians, and that therefore our souls are Western souls. What do you do when your pages stick together? Oh, my God. okay, so now, where do we go from here? I wanted to tackle my subject by themes, and I actually think I'm working my way towards it. What I just did was give you the themes of the book, but when I wrote the book, I wasn't able to do that, so I tackled the subject historically. And I did find that a lot of the things that we take for granted about ourselves and that the rest of Canada do, I don't think are true at all, and I don't think they ever have been, or maybe they once were, but they certainly aren't anymore. Okay, So, I should have mentioned when I was saying, well, you know, this is my point of view, I should have added that I lean to the left politically also, having been born and brought up in Saskatchewan, eh? What else could I do? Although where I live, in my corner of the province, is one of the most right-wing corners in the entire country. And there are reasons for that, historical reasons, which I will get to. Okay, it seems that I'm ready for page 35. We do know, there are, of course, differences among the three prairie provinces. I find Manitoba a calming place, its cities laid back, and its citizens having an attitude that says, we are what we are, and that is just fine. While Alberta bustles, it bustles everywhere, it seems to me. I have even taken to calling the fast lane of Saskatchewan highways the Alberta lane, because Albertans, except for the occasional Ontario vehicle, always drive faster than anyone else. If Manitoba is laid back and calm and Alberta sharp and fast, Saskatchewan cities always seem a bit bewildered to me, as if this wasn't quite what they had in mind. But here we are, and what the heck, we'll just have to make the best of it. And if I always see Manitoba and Saskatchewan in my own mind covered with a thin layer of fine dust, Alberta seems to me polished and shiny and bright as a new penny. The differences among the provinces are mostly a result of the settlement patterns and of who the first settlers in each province were, and in turn this is explained, although only partly, by the physical nature of the landscape of each province. And by this I mean that the most beautiful parts of Alberta, ranching country, were settled by moneyed people, many from England, sometimes even titled, while Saskatchewan was settled by farming people, reed peasants, from all over the Caucasian world. A million of them, at least in the south, were Americans. And Manitoba, the oldest of the three provinces, had a more interesting beginning, with the first people to settle being Métis and half-breeds, as they were known by everyone then, the difference being that the Métis are half-French and half-First Nations, usually Roman Catholic, while so-called half-breeds were usually Protestants, half the offspring of a parent from an English-speaking country, chiefly England and Scotland, as well as Orkney, and the other half First Nations. The Red River or Selkirk settlers arrived next, and then the settlers followed the more usual pattern for Western Canada, with many Mennonites and unusually a sizable contingent in Manitoba of Icelanders. There was even a country called New Iceland, or rather a chunk of the country called literally New Iceland, which I've forgotten precisely how many thousand, but is now down to about 1,200. I think I better just go back here now, having said that I don't view the Prairie Provinces entirely as a monolith. And have any of you seen the New Canadian Geographic? There's some really interesting maps and stories in there. I see some of you have, about the ways that people wanted to see the provinces divided and how the federal government decided on this, you know, and what a mistake I think it was, and a lot of other people do too, rather than this way. Well, I did start with what was here when we arrived, 60 million bison, perhaps as many as, now I'm trying to remember the figure, a third to a half a million First Nations people in the entire area of Canada, which is, I gather, only an estimate, and all kinds of birds and animals that we can only dream of seeing nowadays. Plus this natural beauty, undammed rivers, uncut forests, unturned grasslands, and of course those 60 million bison. On the slim evidence, now, I suppose that the first myth about the West that is in the process of being overturned, and I'm glancing nervously at a classical archaeologist here, hoping he doesn't know anything about North America. You know, we were all told that that Aboriginal people came across the Bering Sea when there was a land bridge, walked down an ice-free passage on the eastern side of the Rocky Mountains, and thus dispersed throughout first North America and then southward through the rest of the two continents. But I'm sure that you are all aware that there is evidence being turned up, and I wouldn't want to start a war because archaeologists are very undecided about this, that in fact it is possible, maybe is a better word, that in fact these continents, the Americas, were actually populated by people coming across the Pacific and 30 to 40,000 years ago. And so that when Aboriginal people make the claim that they have always been here, they may well be right. But I know that the archaeologists, if you're interested in a book for lay people about this, which I found absolutely fascinating, it's by the journalist Elaine Dewar, D-E-W-A-R, and it's called Bones. It's an amazing book, but I think it really annoyed a lot of archaeologists. Well... anyway, so there we have probably the first myth of the West, which is that, after all, we're all immigrants, including First Nations people, when the likelihood is that this is not true at all and that they have always been right. So I've already talked a little bit about our relationship with nature, but one of the things that we believe in the Prairie Province is that we are rural, and the rest of the country believes this about us too. And in fact, if you look at the statistics, you will find out that cities grew up along with the farming culture, along with the people who were out working on the land in whatever capacity, that we have had cities as long as we have had rural people. We have had city people. At this very moment, although this has not always been true, Western Canada is as urban as all the rest of Canada, and Canada is an urban country. The statistics vary depending on what you call rural and what you call urban, but the fact is, a figure that everybody can live with is to say that in Saskatchewan, Alberta, and Manitoba, 70% of the people are urban. The odd thing about this is that all our myths, all our stories of our past in the Prairie Provinces have to do with the farm. And yet I myself have cousins who never lived on a farm till I married my current husband 30 years ago. So, but my parents came from the farm, and my sisters and I were raised, as with almost every prairie person I ever talked to about this, with the idea that the farm was the lost paradise, and that that's where we all came from. And yet, when I began to examine my own family, I realized that we have cousins who grew up in the city of Calgary who never lived on a farm in their lives, and cousins in Winnipeg, in both San Boniface and in the Anglo part of the city, who have been urban people all their lives. And the peculiar thing about this, and I owe George Melnick and Don Kerr some credit for pointing this out to me, first of all, was that, but nonetheless, we don't have myths of who we are that are about our cities, our city beginnings. They're all about the farm and rural life and our wilderness past, which is very peculiar. So let me see. I realize I'm almost out of town, out of time. That was a Freudian slip, and I've hardly scratched the surface here. So I'm going to start speeding it up a bit. The question of what we meant when we spoke about wilderness. Now, I was going to read sections, but obviously I don't have time to do that. So I would just say that when my parents, my grandparents, and my aunt and uncle went around 1937 to brand new land, which they were to open up, they were the first batch of settlers. I mean, there were others as well who were our neighbors, all arrived at about the same time to the edge of the boreal forest in what is really east central Saskatchewan, but as far as we were concerned, it was north, and believe me, it was north enough. They believed that they were the first people in this wilderness. What they did not know, but would know now if they were living, and in fact, I guess only my mother's sister is still living of those people, and she's very elderly and in Prince Albert, never left the area. Apparently, perhaps Uncle Charlie knew, but I don't think that anyone else realized that every square inch of this land that was wilderness to them was already named and well known to the Aboriginal people. And in fact, if you look at the book when it comes out, you'll find that the archaeologist, Dr. David Meyer, who has made that part of Saskatchewan his life's work among the First Nations people there, did an early monograph on the Cree names for the places and translated them. And I've, you know, White Fox Garrick, who was named after David Garrick, the British actor. A White Fox, we don't know. Even his informants couldn't tell him where that name came from. All of these places had other names, so that they were well known and well used. It was not a wilderness. So part of our belief in the heroism of our pioneers was based on the idea that they came to a new, unsettled land, and they opened it up. If they had come understanding that they were far, far from the first people, perhaps they would not have viewed themselves in such a mythic light, nor would we today. That's just one of the things that I postulate that will get a lot of people upset, I'm sure. So I'm going to skip on to the next one. I've already talked about the idea of the West as rural. We have always been as urban as we have been rural, right from the start. And our cities, you know, Saskatoon was opened up in 1882. Winnipeg was the oldest, 1738. La Vérendrye built a fort at the confluence of the Assiniboine and Red Rivers that eventually became Winnipeg. Edmonton was in the late 18th century. Calgary was very new. It was the late 19th century before it became a city. But then they just burgeoned. You know, like there's 10 people, say, in 1890. By 1900, there's 20,000. And when you consider the effect that this huge, I mean, I haven't even gotten to the Dominion Lands Act or women or all the rest of it or our racism and so on and so forth. When you consider that there's probably never been, now I say this rather hesitantly, a society anywhere else on the planet that we know about where people were brought in such vast numbers virtually overnight to create a country, and that it's amazing that we're as lawful and orderly and organized as we are. I'm sure this is something you're all aware of, but, you know, the American heroes of that period and the period 100 years before that were the outlaws and the wild sheriffs. And who were our heroes in Western Canada? The Mounties. That's pretty weird, eh? But nonetheless, it's true. So now, where do I go? I have so much I want to say. I thought perhaps if I could just find this, I would... I'll just tell you. So in the period between, you know, I can say 1890 just to give myself room, but it's probably actually more like 1900 to about 1920, 3 million people came in to that area of the Prairie Provinces, and they came from only the Caucasian world, of course, as you know. And there was a whole society that was set up for the growing and selling of wheat. And every farm family that was put on a quarter section of land was there to grow crops, to feed into this structure that was there already ahead of time for them, which is another extraordinary thing, I think. And, of course, because the American system of land division was introduced immediately, and I haven't even said anything about the Riel resistance, 1869 and 70, and the Manitoba Act, followed by 1885, the Riel rebellion in Saskatchewan. The extraordinary thing is that using this system of land tenure, first of all, it was applied indiscriminately to the ground, just whether there was a lake in the middle of it or rocks or forests or badlands, that was still the quarter section that you filed on. The other thing that it did was every section of land, which is a mile by a mile and 640 acres, ensured that farm women would be lonely. Because there would be only, and the thing was, the preemption, which was the quarter section next to you, was the assumption was if you could fulfill your land claim, then you could get the next half, the next quarter, so you'd have a half a section. The built-in idea right from the start was that you were going to get bigger and bigger and bigger, which, of course, the land itself was never viable. It meant that farm women would be lonely. Would be on their own. What is that? That's... Oh, okay. As long as there's no sniper up there or something, that's how you get me finished here. I'm just going to go through this. I haven't gotten anywhere near the French. It was a wonderful world for men. I guess maybe I'll go to that. It really was a wonderful world for men, where men could, if they could survive at all, could prove themselves and could create homes and lives for their families and could take immense pride in having succeeded. But the fact is that overall something like 6 out of 10 homesteads failed, or rather homesteaders, because some places would be filed on over and over again. There were deaths of whole families from diphtheria and scarlet fever and so on and so forth. And in southeast Alberta and southwest Saskatchewan, the level of poverty and difficulty was really the kind of things you see in developing countries. And the rate was 6 out of 10 total failure. And some historian, whose name I've forgotten now, said about it that this free land turned out to be unconscionably expensive in human life. Now, I'm certainly hoping I do a better job of this next time I have to do it, but my feeling is that I haven't really given you much of the flavor of the book, so I think I'd just go straight to women. All the women of my family were pioneers, grandmothers, great-grandmothers, And my husband's mother, my own mother, I was raised in pioneering conditions, as were my sisters, myself. So I just want to tell you this, and I'm there are probably Western historians sitting in the room, but I'm hoping not. You know that the system of primogeniture was the one that has always been used among landowning peoples in Canada. So that although the Slovaks, where my husband's father came from, the land was divided equally among the sons, not the daughters, what happened was eventually the land, there was no land left. So people were getting smaller and smaller bits, and that's why they came to Canada. But the British system of primogeniture, which I understand was introduced around the time of the Norman conquest in Britain, provided for the eldest son inheriting. And it never provided for daughters. So we came with that idea to start with. Of course, there have always been exceptions, but generally that's the rule. And by the Homestead Act, no, our act was called the Dominion Lands Act, and it was instituted in 1872. And by the Dominion Lands Act, men could get the free homestead. Women could not, unless they were widows or divorcees who had dependent children under the age of 18, which they had to be able to prove. And that meant that, in effect, women could not get homesteads unless they bought them. In the United States in 1862, the Homestead Act was introduced, and it was a truly egalitarian act. Men or women could, on an equal basis, get land. And so that stereotype that I remember seeing in Western movies, Western American movies, of this tough old babe who had a gun and had her own land and ran things and people didn't cross her, was in fact based on something real. We didn't have that tradition in Canada because women could not get land. As if that were not bad enough, and I'm not going to be able to find the date. It was something like between 1880 and 1890, in fact, the people who governed the West took away the dower rights from Western women. Women in Ontario had dower rights, women in the United States, and women in Britain had had dower rights for a very long time, but Western Canadian women did not have them. And the only explanation that I can find for this was so that so as not to impede land registration, and you'll have to interpret what that means. But, of course, women who were more fortunate than the great bulk of Western women out in the land then went to work to do something about this. And, as you know, none of us had the vote. But it seems to me that conditions were so bad out on the land at that time for women that it was Western women who organized and fought and got Canadian women the vote. They were the ones who led the way. The women in Manitoba, a month later Saskatchewan, and then just almost immediately. And then the rest of the country followed, ending, as you know, with Quebec in the 40s. It was also Western women who's, we also have the highest rate of spousal homicide, and as you know, spousal homicide means it's the women who get killed. It rarely means the husbands. And we led the country in the enacting of legislation specifically against domestic violence. All Western provinces were first. Saskatchewan, in fact, was the first in the country. So that's kind of a peculiar and interesting thing. So I am of the belief, if you haven't already figured it out, one of the two, and I'm going to go straight to the end here, of the two most important things it seems to me that we should think about when we think of what makes a Westerner is the fact that Western women have never gotten a fair shake. I have a whole spiel I can do on land ownership, having been in Ethiopia and having seen what happens to the women there, and I am a believer in the continuum of women's rights. And I live in the country, and of all the people who own farms out there, I know exactly three women who farm, who actually do the work themselves on their own places. And there has to be a reason for that, and it's not in the law, it's in the culture. So one of my main arguments is that Western Canada has always been non-egalitarian in two senses. The first, our refusal to come to terms with the historical wrong that our ancestors, and thus we, did to the Aboriginal people. And secondly, that women have never gotten a fair shake in the West, and that this is something we have to recognize and try to do something about. So, I'm going to end now. Am I doing about right here? Yeah? Oh, that's what I figured. I didn't get started till about 20 after, and they told me 50 minutes. So, first of all, in the end, in answer to those first questions that I began with, that I said we had a basic and unspoken anxiety, which is, if we are neither truly indigenous to this continent, nor are we Europeans, then who are we and where is home? I would begin by saying that we will never be at home until all of us come to terms with, recognize, and accept that our ancestors and our government did the Aboriginal people of the West one of the great, all-time great historical wrongs, and that this will never be, and this is my point, this will never be this West, our true home, until we accept our responsibility on behalf of our ancestors and work towards some kind of equality, a reconciliation, a humility in the face of a people who have never consented to our rule, despite the fact that they would often pretend they did while other stuff was going on behind the scenes. Witness the great rise. The power of those cultures is most evident in the fact that despite everything that we did to stamp them out, they're growing stronger every day. I firmly believe that until, and I'm not talking about people like you, this is kind of preaching to the converted. I'm talking about the people out there on the streets, the people in the city of Saskatoon where I come from, who are so appallingly racist that they don't even know they're racist. I interviewed a Mountie recently, a staff sergeant, who was so hostile that, it was a total waste of my time. But he did, in one of his many rants, he ranted just about everything. One of them was, "I wasn't here. I didn't do it. This is a Mountie." Well, it just stuns me to think that people could be so stupid. Present company accepted. Secondly, that in our talk, our memories, our beliefs about the West since settlement, that we give Western women an equal place, that we demote or even happily, I would hope, destroy the icon of the real man, that is the cowboy, not my husband though, just that one you see on TV. And even the Aboriginal warrior, I mean, these are our icons, eh? The cowboy, the warrior, the yeoman farmer, despite the fact there never was a yeoman farmer in all of Western Canada, and that we get rid of these as icons of the true West and elevate in a more meaningful way the gifts the women of the West have given all of us from their very lives and the lives of their children. If you've read the documents in the provincial archives, as I did when I was a young woman, a young university student working there, you know that that is the truth. They gave their lives and their youth and their strength to their attempts to make the West live up to its promise as an egalitarian society, and to their work of creating a home for all of us. And so I'm going to end with the last section of the book. And my sister, who is actually the person who about whom I'm going to read to you, is here tonight. A couple of years ago, my older sister, who has lived for more than 40 years in British Columbia, most of it in the wet and snowy north, came home to Saskatoon for a visit. I phoned to make sure she had arrived without incident and to inquire as to her plans. She told me that she had just returned from a long, slow drive with our brother-in-law through all the places of our youth in that city. And the lilacs, she said. Oh, the lilacs. They're in bloom everywhere here. They brought back everything, she said, meaning the prairie home she had been missing and dreaming of all those long years she was exiled on the edge of the mountains and the border of the sea. Her voice full of a tender wonder, she said, how the lilacs were blooming along the edge of sidewalks, every shade from deep purple to white, and how their unique, exquisite scent rode lightly on the air for blocks in every direction. But mostly, she could hardly articulate the emotion that they stirred in her. She didn't need to, because I understood completely, and listening to her, I realized how lilacs are and have been for 100 years a symbol of the Prairie West. I remembered how there are among the ordinary people of the Prairie West, at least, always lilacs in yards, as hedges along the sidewalk or in farms leaning against the old, original settler's house, abandoned years ago for a more modern one. There they continue to bloom, half wild, often in rich shades hard to find today, filling the air with their wonderful perfume and the surest sign after crocuses that winter won't be returning for many months. They are everywhere in the old Prairie West, because in a landscape once seen as bare and not pretty and not home, settlers brought lilacs with them from the old country as a plant with showy blooms comparable to the hothouse roses and hydrangea that they had had at home but that would not grow out here. Almost certainly those who planted them did not know that they had come from China by way of Persia to the Turks who gave them to the Europeans in the mid-1500s and were first introduced into the United States as far back as 1680 by a French Huguenot physician, Dr. John Durand. Nor would most of them have known that there is a native North American lilac called Mountain Balm that was apparently well known to First Nations people of the far west. As settlement spread across the plains, always moving west, women created a trail of lilacs, an image I prefer to that of the fearless, free cowboy on his bronc, or its opposite, the kindly yeoman farmer with the gnarled face and hands covered in the dust of his fields, or the dream of my Irish grandfather that he might be seen as a true child of the West, born on the very Western earth. I didn't tell you that story, but it's the emblematic story that I come back to through the whole book. The West is not now and has never been only a man's country. Women created it too, leaving behind places they knew for one they did not and bringing with them what they could to remind them of the old home and family that many would never see again. Though they gave their very lives to the male dream, within it they tried to create, as women always have, pleasant places in which to live and raise their families. So I prefer to think of marking the way across the West and embedding itself just as firmly as the farmer or the cowboy in the deepest prairie soul, a scented trail of white, mauve, and purple lilacs, every one of them an eloquent emblem of, at the first, the home left behind, but today, of home itself. Now, I suppose if I were smart, I'd just shut up now and sit down. But I feel obliged to point out that I have avoided all the hard material in this book and stuck with sentiments. So because you are, I gather, an academic crowd, or at least a crowd of the well-educated, I want you to know that there's a lot of hard labor in this book and dates and numbers and facts. So what I've really done is just distilled the gist of my argument for you, and I've had to leave out all kinds of things that I really care about, like the role of the French in the West, which was that if they were founding founding peoples of this entire country, they were also, although we do not ever recognize this, and always remembering that the Aboriginal people whose land this was, is, you know, were here first. But the founders of the West were also the French, and this is an historical fact. And it is of great interest because we are seen as these terrible rednecks in the rest of the country who refuse to recognize the French fact that in fact, and I can give you the statistics, at this very moment in Alberta, 25% of all children between kindergarten in grade 12 are studying French at some level. In Saskatchewan, from kindergarten to grade 12, 45% of all children are. And in Manitoba, despite all the laws and the trouble that we know we've all had about the status of the French language, in Manitoba, 50% of people, children from kindergarten to grade 12 are studying French, either from immersion to language lessons. So I think the idea that we are rural rednecks, despite gun control, and I am not in favor of Bill C-68, we are not. This one myth we can hopefully get rid of is that we are not a redneck nation by any means. Anyway, having diluted my poetic ending, I will say thank you so much for your attention. You've been a terrific audience, and it was a great pleasure to be here.
Questions?
Oh, right, yeah.
You know, the Vancouver Institute always has a tradition of giving the audience a chance to ask questions of the speaker. And as many of you perhaps don't know, the Vancouver Institute goes back to just 11 years after Alberta and Saskatchewan became provinces in 1905. It's February of 1916 the Institute got started. So you can continue the tradition now by putting some questions to our speaker.
I wonder if you could speak a little bit about your the buffalo and what you and the
customer are dealing with. Sure. It seems to me that I can't write anything anymore without mentioning the bison or the buffalo. We have, what was the Batala Ranch is now the Old Man on His Back Prairie and Heritage Conservation Area. It's known, owned jointly by the Nature Conservancy of Canada and the provincial government. But the Nature Conservancy of Canada, of course, is the one that manages and runs it. And part of our dream was, first of all, that Peter's 13,000 acres of prairie grass, native grass, would stay in grass when he had to retire, which is what's happened. He's 70 now. And the rest of the dream was that the land, the 1,200 of the 13,000 acres that had been broken would be restored to prairie grass, which is not an easy thing to do. And it's a very expensive thing to do. And that is happening. And the third and most exciting dream of all was that we might bring back the genuine purebred Plains bison, and that's what happened a year ago, December 12th, a year ago, 50 head came from the Elk Island Preserve in Alberta, 25 males, 25 females, which is the ratio in nature, in the wild. These are disease-free animals, and for 75 years they've been disease-free and uncontaminated by contact with cattle or wood bison. And It was the most wonderful moment, one of the most wonderful moments of my life, the day in May when they came bursting through the gates and did this big, they ran this way and then they swerved and they ran this way in front of all of us. We got this wonderful look at them and I just burst into tears because it was just this wonderful moment. And what has been so amazing to all of us is that people have been interested from not only all over Canada, it was apparently reported on CNN and also in Europe that this great moment had happened. So I don't know what you know about buffalo, but these buffalo, they don't breed until the end of the second year, which would be the end of like next
this coming, a year from now, they'll be 2 years old. They would then be able to breed the another year before they deliver. So, and their fertility rate is not as high as with domestic cattle. And you leave them alone. You don't do anything to them. And because, you know, as soon as you start messing around with them, then they're not wild animals anymore. And, well, you know, I could go on forever. Anyway, you cannot imagine how much fun it's been watching these guys, because they're not anything like cattle, not even like range cattle, in the way they act, the things that they do. And when you have a terrible prairie blizzard, and all the cows in the country, their noses are blue and their backs are hunched up and they're backed into a fence corner, freezing to death, the bison are out playing. And then they just drop down in the snowbanks and go to sleep. It's the most wonderful thing. That's a long answer. I won't answer that long if there are other questions. Yes. Well, I can only tell you the theory, because obviously I'm not the one who did it, but I did watch the field. The first thing that happened was that scientists from the University of Alberta came down, and they took plots of land, and they spent a year trying to find the best way to get rid of the invading grasses and the foreign grasses in a field, you know, so that they could get it pure and start again with indigenous grasses. And they tried fire, intense early spring grazing, mowing, and I think just plowing it. And the scientist, we ran into him at the Grasslands National Park. He hadn't published his work yet, but he said he was finished and he knew the answer, and it was intensive early spring grazing that worked best, and he said, as any rancher already knew. So then the next step is to plant the seed, and the seed, oh, now this is so complicated that, and you mustn't take my word for it, but you begin with you identify the indigenous grasses, you get the seed from as close by as the place where you're going to plant it as you can, and you plant, I believe that there were something like a mix of a dozen native plants, very carefully selected. And we can't even, now that we've done that though, we're starting to get into plant breeding problems. We can't take those seeds because a number of them are Echovar, which I think is a trade name. So we can't get our own seed and plant it in the next field. But anyway, we went out, all of us thought, oh my God, if this grows, we'll be so lucky, and the neighbors are all watching and waiting for us to fail, and we're just sort of praying over this field. And it grew. We have pictures of the grass this high. Well, of course, the grass in our country never grows this high. Even if you get 12 inches of rain, it doesn't grow this high. So apparently the scientists tell us that, and the ranchers call that a good catch, that this is how it will be in the first year or two, and then as the years pass, they will settle down, adapt to the specific conditions, and look like all the fields that have never been plowed. But they'll never be exactly the same, because we can still, if you've got the eye for it, you could still spot native grass that the first settlers plowed up 70 years ago and then walked away from, nobody did anything. You can see the difference to this day.
Other questions? Yes.
Sharon, I wanted to invite you for dinner on a return to Ocean, Saskatchewan in the summer. But don't bring a rock climber out.
Okay, it's a deal. Oh, yeah, that was wonderful, wasn't it? Yeah. Well, we can't take all the credit for that. There were foundations, there were all kinds of agencies provided the money that made that possible. The fencing, IPSCO and Regina donated the fencing materials, you know. We had to pay for the fencing, but that money came from the Weston Foundation, you know. So, and if the provincial government had not wanted this to happen, had not been willing for it to happen, it would never have happened, because the neighbors raised hell, you know. And We're still, Peter and I, who have remained in the community and who are the only ones who are in the community, have taken a lot of abuse for this, you know. Peter doesn't care. I care a lot. It's very painful. But I'm getting used to it, too. Although I don't like being yelled at by a total stranger. We had a man come up to us in Jack's Cafe and say to my husband, who is 70 years old, "What would your father say?" Peter was just stunned for 1 second, and then he said, "My father would know that when you can't make it, you know, when you've got to give up, and he would know that I found a good way to give up, you know." And I thank you for the invitation, and I promise not to bring Ralph. Oh, okay. Well, you know, I'll happily give you my address. And we're in the phone book, in the East End phone book. We're the only Batalas.
Other questions? Yes.
Well, you know, I do. You have a copy of her memoirs too, don't you?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, she doesn't mention the CCF, really, does she? It's odd because it was such an important part of their lives. I don't think that they really got involved in that in politics until they gave up being on the land and went into Prince Albert to live. That's my first memory of it. But of course, I was born in 1940, and we left there in 46. So I'm afraid I really don't, and also there's a farmer who now, he was our neighbor then, he now owns my grandparents, your great-grandparents' land, and he had all the documents of the school board meetings because my grandfather was one of the people who started the first school there, and there's no mention of politics, just school politics. It's called A Lilac Moon, and the first chapter explains where that title came from. And Dreaming of the Real West. I started out calling it something like Searching for the Real West, and my editor at HarperCollins said, "That won't do. You got to come up with a better title than that." So, so I did, I hope.
Well, if there are no other questions, then I'll ask the sponsor of this evening's event, Professor Tim Brooks, who's principal of St. John's College, to thank our speaker.
I guess I can sit down?
You can sit down.
I'm afraid Sharon's much shorter than I am. I'll sort of lean over this. As principal of St. John's College, one of the two graduate colleges at UBC, it falls to me to thank Sharon. And I was going to talk about meeting her outside of Jack's Cafe in East End, Saskatchewan last August, and deciding upon meeting her immediately that I had to have her come and be our guest here at UBC. But I'm not going to do that. I was also going to talk about how, what a wonderful person she is. She's a little intimidating when you know her from her books, because there's a deep spiritual and artistic resonance in her work, and you just think, oh my God, how can we live with someone like that for a week? But she's as funny as you've probably detected, and even smarter. Instead, I'm going to thank her by giving her my own lilac reminiscence, if I may. I'm one of those annoying Easterners who spends his summer on an Ojibwe reserve in Ontario. It's on an island, it's called the Beausoleil First Nation. There's lilacs there. The lilacs were planted, the Indian agent was the white appointee of the government who was supposed to take care of native affairs because natives were assumed to not have that capacity. And so he has the biggest house on the island still is the house built for the Indian agent, and it's surrounded with lilac bushes. Now, these bushes have just gone wild. They're huge, they're vast, they're growing in all directions. But there's an association for me when I see the lilac bushes. Of course, I think also of my childhood growing up in Eastern Canada, lilacs everywhere.
And there's a kind of awkward association for me because I see them as the flower that decorates the Indian agent's house. However, down on the furthest, there's a spit of land in the southeastern part of the island, and a lilac bush has seeded itself and is growing in the middle of a sand beach where no lilac bush would sensibly ever want to try and grow. And there it is. It has somehow escaped from that particular, if I can say it, white racist culture that is all part of lilac bushes, and it's escaped and it's gone out onto the First Nations land and is thriving, and I think we're all the better for it. So my little lilac bush thanks all of your very large lilac bushes.